Welcome to the fourth podcast in this series, in which I discuss that peculiar Western musical institution, the orchestra. I'm Stephen Larson, music director of the Rockford Symphony. In the last podcast, I talked about the creation of opera at the beginning of the 17th century and how its particular needs enabled a relatively new instrument, the violin, to become established as the preferred instrument for opera accompaniment, and how the violin family eventually pushed the viol family to virtual extinction. It was the presence, the domination of the violin family instruments that led to a standardization of instrumental ensembles that allowed us to call them orchestras. Today, at long last, and as promised and postponed, I'd like to start talking about the orchestra strings, focusing first on the violin. There are more strings in the orchestra than any other instrument, and the violins outnumber the violas, cellos, and basses. Throughout these podcasts, I've been using one word, orchestra, to mean two related but different things, and I'd like to clear up any possible confusion between them. First, there is the generic orchestra, that violin-based ensemble we've described and discussed. In an earlier podcast, I said that ensembles we'd call orchestras began to appear about 1650, but it's probably more accurate to say that composers began writing music about that time for what would eventually be called orchestras. They wrote the music and the proper musicians were hired to play it. Demand for these violin-based orchestras led eventually to the creation of the institution of the orchestra, which were ongoing ensembles created specifically to play music written for the generic orchestra. This took a while. Historians can and do quibble as to where and when the first institutional orchestra was founded, but the Leipzig Gewandhaus Orchestra, founded in 1743, is usually given that honor. And that was about 90 years after generic orchestras began to appear. The orchestra as an institution took a while to establish, but once it was, it became the vehicle for which composers wrote music. What were the factors that led to the creation of the orchestra as an institution? How did the generic orchestra eventually lead to the great body of symphonic literature we enjoy today? That's a subject I'm going to defer until after we've had a discussion of all the instruments of the orchestra, so let's put that on hold. We'll start today about talking about the violins, which have been defining orchestral instruments for 300 years. But first, permit me to rhapsodize about the sheer physical beauty of the violin and ask you to do the same. Have human hands ever created a more beautiful musical instrument than a viola or a violin or a cello? I think not. The graceful curves, the symmetry, the balance of proportions, the capricious tucking in at the waist, the decorative and lyrical F-holes facing each other across the instrument's top, the warm glow of its wood bringing to mind the many shades of human hair, dusky blonde, golden, auburn, red, chestnut, all brought into prominent relief by the touches of black ebony. From a distance, the top and bottom might look flat, like a guitar, but upon closer inspection, they are subtly, almost organically curved. Many an artist or photographer has posed a nude woman seated, her back to the viewer, with F-holes painted on the small of her back, doubly sensuous as it recalls the shape of a violin. With no disrespect intended to flutes, oboes, clarinets, bassoons, horns, trumpets, trombones, or tuba, the violin and its family members are simply out of this world gorgeous. Those brilliant 16th century luthiers working in Brescia, Cremona, and Venice created a family of instruments that border on perfection, acoustically and visually. The violin is truly a thing of beauty. But of course, beauty isn't enough. The violin is as close to acoustically perfect as any instrument ever made, even approaching the perfection of the instrument it was meant to emulate, the human voice. No other instrument has the emotional appeal of the violin, and no other instrument could match its agility and brilliant figurations. In the hands of a skilled player, the violin can be tender and lyrical or brilliant and dramatic. Only the piano has a greater range. Almost from its very beginnings, composers saw its versatility as a solo instrument, as part of a small chamber ensemble, or massed together to form a section of an orchestra. But why is the violin considered to be the devil's instrument? Well, that's a great question. Thanks for asking. It could have started with the story of Nero fiddling while Rome burned, but the violin hadn't been invented yet. Some historians actually think that Nero was singing. Some point to the early days of the violin in the 16th century when it became popular for accompanying village dances. Some early Protestant factions believed dancing to be one of the devil's snares to sin, and so the violin became the devil's instrument. Then there was Niccolo Paganini, an Italian violinist virtuoso who lived from 1782 to 1840 and became the first classical superstar. His technical skills were so astonishing that they were thought to be beyond human capabilities, almost acts of sorcery. He was gaunt, mysterious, always dressed in black. Rumors spread that he had sold his soul to Satan in exchange for his talents, and that the gut strings on his violin were made from the intestines of his murdered lovers. Of course, this only served to make him more famous. Selling one's soul to the devil in exchange for talent, wealth, or success is a meme that's been around for millennia. But when one witnesses a violinist, a virtuoso violinist, unleashing the arsenal of musical fireworks invented by Paganini, one is tempted to believe in infernal intervention. It's much more exciting than the harps that the angels play, don't you think? The violin is the apex version of a long history of stringed instruments that were first plucked, then bowed by pulling a ribbon of stretched horsehair across the string, causing it to vibrate and produce a sustained sound like singing. Its ancestors include the Arabic rebab and especially the Byzantine lira. Until fairly recent times, musical instruments didn't really have a standard design. An instrument maker could choose to copy an earlier instrument or could experiment, looking for a musical improvement or maybe just adding some decorative features. From the 9th century until the 16th century, bowed string instruments underwent a steady stream of alterations that culminated in the violin family. But first, before we go on, I promised you a violin joke. In an apartment building in the Upper West Side of Manhattan, a young man is busy practicing the Tchaikovsky violin concerto. A woman who lives down the hall knocks on the door to his apartment, and the violinist opens it. "Yes," he asks. The woman says, "Has anyone ever told you you were a great violinist?" The man blushed and smiled, replying, "Well, no, not really." The woman said, "Did you ever wonder why?" All right, it wasn't that funny. Truth be told, there really aren't very many good violin jokes. Most of them are puns playing off of how violence sounds a lot like violins. And the rest are variations of the little boy who went to his violin lesson, opened his case, and discovered a machine gun. "Oh no," he cried, "my dad's robbing a bank with my violin." But just wait till the next podcast. Viola jokes are coming, and that's when we'll hit the jackpot. The violin is, in essence, a hollow box over which strings, pulled tight, are strung. It looks simple, but it's actually one of the most complex of all instruments. There are 70 parts in the violin, each handmade and hand-fitted by a master craftsman. Since reaching near perfection in the late 1500s, not much has changed in 400 years. The top, or belly, or soundboard, which is the side facing up when a violinist plays, is slightly arched and is carved from a panel of European spruce, a softwood. The back, or bottom, is also arched, carved from maple, a hardwood. The part that separates the top from the bottom, the sides, are called the ribs, and they are also carved from maple. The top and bottom hang over the ribs slightly, unlike guitars, lutes, and viols where the edges are flush. Every part of the violin's body is held together with glue made from boiled animal hides, an ancient, if rather smelly, adhesive. Yes, stronger and more permanent glues have been invented, but they would not allow the instrument to be taken apart for repairs. This makes me think, I know some violinists who are seriously committed vegans and animal rights activists who won't wear leather, wool, or any material made from animals. I wonder how they feel about the glue that holds their violins together. One holds the violin by the neck, which is attached to the top of the instrument. At the top of the neck, the peg box is carved out, where the tuning pegs are inserted. At the end of the neck, an ornamental scroll is carved. It's primarily decorative, but also practical, serving as a hook by which you can hang up the instrument. The fingerboard is glued onto the upper surface of the neck. The four strings are secured to the tailpiece, which is not really attached to the body of the violin, but hooked onto a button at the bottom of the violin by a thick loop of gut or nylon. The strings are supported by a carefully fitted maple bridge, stretch over the fingerboard, and are wound around the tuning pegs. The fingerboard is made of ebony, an extremely hard and dense wood, unaffected by changes in humidity and resistant to the constant abrasion of the fingers and strings. The tuning pegs are either ebony or rosewood, which is another very dense and hard wood. The sound holes, or F holes, are symmetrical openings shaped like the script letter F, cut into the top. They have an obvious acoustical purpose, allowing the sound to emerge from the instrument, but are also, frankly, decorative. An unseen but critical component is the sound post, a small spruce dowel that is inserted through one of the F holes to an acoustically strategic spot near the bridge, where it spans the gap between the top and the bottom, bracing against the pressure of the tightened strings and serving as a conduit for vibrations to the instrument. The exact placement of the sound post and the position of the bridge are critical to the sound of the instrument. The waist, although it looks decorative, has a practical purpose. It serves as a channel for the bow to pass through when it's angled to play the highest or the lowest string. The bridge stands the strings off the fingerboard just enough that they will vibrate freely, but close enough that they can be easily pushed down by the fingers. It is arched slightly from side to side so that any two adjacent strings can be bowed at the same time, but any single string can be played without contacting another string. Violin strings were originally made from gut, but later refinements wound the gut strings with silver or copper. The Industrial Revolution made it possible for strings to be made of wire, made of steel or nickel, again wound with silver. Metal strings, not surprisingly, have a stronger and more piercing sound and also stay in tune better than gut strings. The whole instrument, except for the fingerboard, tailpiece, bridge, and tuning pegs, is carefully varnished, giving it that wonderful luster and glow. The varnish is also functional, acting as a protectant and preservative. Inferior varnish can dull an instrument's sound, but contrary to popular belief, varnish cannot significantly enhance the sound. This would be a good time to talk about the legendary violins made by the great Italian luthiers of the 17th century, known like Antonio Stradivari, Giuseppe Guarnieri, and members of the Amati family. The instruments they made were known for their big sound and responsiveness to the most delicate touch. They have been coveted by collectors, handed down from generation to generation, sold at auction for enormous sums, loaned to promising young artists. Everybody, even people who know and care nothing about classical music, know that Stradivarius violins are worth millions of dollars. They have been carefully and minutely studied, precisely measured and qualitatively analyzed, and have served as the models for tens of thousands of imitations, all of which sought to replicate the qualities of the originals. Most anybody in the classical musical world has dealt at some time with some excited person who has found an old violin in a deceased relative's attic, and looking inside saw a dusty label that said in Latin, Antonio Stradivari of Cremona, made in the year 1716. And we have to then gently bring them down to earth by telling them that, number one, every Stradivarius violin ever made has been accounted for, and two, the label is simply a statement that the violin's maker has attempted to copy the specifications for Stradivarius violin made in that year. Sometimes, not often, that violin can actually be decent, but still, it ain't a Strad. It was obvious to anyone who played one of these instruments that they were special. But why? For years, some luthiers speculated that the key was the varnish. If only they could discover the secret ingredients used to make the varnish, they too could make great violins. But others reasoned that Stradivari and his colleagues made varnish out of common ingredients that were readily available in their region. Modern chemical analysis technology has proved them right. There's nothing special in the varnish. That wasn't the secret to their success. The best theory that explains the exceptional quality of these instruments involves the wood. From 1300 to about 1850, the world experienced a period of lower temperatures that has been called the Little Ice Age. Cooler than normal winters caused seas to freeze over and glaciers to overrun villages in the Alps. Cooler summers led to extreme destructive weather and widespread crop failure. Centuries of cold temperatures slowed the growth of trees, creating closer growth rings and denser wood. And this is the wood that the Italian luthiers used to build their violins. When a tree grows, it adds on girth by forming growth rings. In the spring, when the sap runs, a dark layer of resinous material is deposited. For the rest of the growing season, a lighter colored layer of carbohydrates is laid down. In cooler summers, this layer is thinner. The dark resinous layers conduct sound very well, while the lighter carbohydrate layer tends to dampen it. Wood taken from trees that grew during the Little Ice Age had thinner carbohydrate layers. Violins made from them had a stronger sound and were more resonant. Denser wood plus superior craftsmanship equaled great violins. There are many reasons why the violin became the preferred string instrument, but they all basically derive from the fact that these instruments produced a more powerful sound than the viols of the day. It also didn't hurt that viols had to be played while sitting down, but the violins were held on the arm under the chin, and they could be played standing or even while walking, placing the violin on equal footing, as it were, with wind and brass instruments of the day. Okay, let's talk about how the violin produces its sound, the bow. The bow is the secret to the violin's success. In the hands of an expert, the bow can make a violin sing like an angel, howl like the devil, perform musical, breathtaking acrobatics, and make otherworldly, ethereal sounds. The first bows looked very much like their namesake. Knock an arrow on the horsehair, pull it back, let it go, and shoot the conductor. It was a curved wooden stick with a band of horsehair strung across. Hair from the tails of horses was chosen because, with the possible exceptions of Rapunzel and Lady Godiva, horses are the only sources of hair long enough to string a bow. Rosin is rubbed onto the horsehair, making it slightly sticky and allowing it to grab the string, making it vibrate. Rosin is basically just dried up pine sap. These bows were very similar to the bows used to play viols, except that violinists held it with the hand on top, and the gambists held it underhand. The overhand grip gave violinists greater control and allowed them to press harder onto the strings, creating a bigger sound. But over time, violinists also wanted more tension on the hair in order to let the bow bounce more quickly from one note to the next. In the late 1700s, a bow with a reverse curve was designed, stiffening the stick and allowing more tension on the hair. A screw mechanism tightened the hair, straightening the curve somewhat. This bow made possible many articulation techniques that were impossible or difficult on the older bows, and this is the bow string players use today. The old-style bows are still around. They're called Baroque bows and are used by string players who try to recreate original instrument practices. Modern recurve bows are called Tourte bows, named after the most famous bow maker of that time. The best bows are and always have been made from Pernambuco, an exotic and rare wood that grows only in Brazil. It's the only wood that holds its curve when cut thin, and unfortunately it's endangered. Other parts of the bow are made from materials such as mother of pearl, silver, leather, and in older bows, ivory. Ivory can create a problem for violinists who travel across international borders because of the worldwide ban on its use. A good bow can easily cost $10,000 or much more. Modern technology offers a cheaper alternative to Pernambuco, carbon fiber. Snob appeal aside, some carbon fiber bows approach the quality of Pernambuco bows. Unlike viols, violins don't have frets. Having frets on the fingerboard might seem to help make intonation more secure, but without frets, violinists can adjust their fingers to play any note absolutely in tune. When playing a viol, if the gut strings start to go out of tune, as gut strings are wont to do, your only recourse is to stop playing and retune the instrument. On the violin, great leaps which were difficult or impossible in other instruments could be navigated with ease. Fast execution of notes, scales, and broken chords are possible for even moderately skilled players. It takes very little effort to play the violin, unlike other wind and brass instruments. And if one avoids the open strings, violins can play with absolute perfect intonation, a feat that is difficult, if not impossible, for every other instrument except the trombone. The range of the violin family from lowest to highest is almost as wide as the scope of human hearing. Two adjacent strings can be played simultaneously, producing harmonies, and in the hands of an experienced performer, it creates the illusion of playing a duet with oneself. Playing two strings at once is called a double stop. Drawing the bow quickly over three or even four strings, triple and quadruple stops, produces broken chords that can be very dramatic. All bowed string instruments are played with the left hand holding the neck and the right hand moving the bow. The fingerboards are contoured for this, and the instruments aren't designed to be played with the opposite hand. Still, if nobody is around to tell you differently, it happens. Occasionally, rural fiddlers will take a hand-me-down violin, grab its neck with the right hand and the bow with the left, and teach themselves to play. In my first years with the RSO, we had a cellist who played with reversed hands. As a little girl, she very much wanted to play the cello, but a joint problem in her right arm made it impossible to extend the bow fully. Her parents had a cello specially built to reverse the strings. I have to tell you, it was very disconcerting to watch her, but she was a very fine player. Playing with a bow looks deceptively simple. A bow can only go in two directions, up or down. All the magic happens with how. The part of the bow closest to the hand is called the frog. Never mind, nobody really knows why. The end of the bow is the tip, and that's pretty obvious. Playing near the frog puts the weight of the hand right over the string, producing a decisive and firm tone, even rough if you want it to be. The strongest, most decisive bow strokes start at the frog, and pulling the bow in this direction is called a down bow. As the bow nears the tip, the pressure placed on the string becomes less, and the sound gets softer, which in musical terms is called a diminuendo. An up bow, starting at the tip and moving to the frog, gradually increases the pressure on the string, and the sound gets louder, a natural crescendo. Getting the right tension on the hair allows the player to let the bow bounce off the strings. Players learn to control the bounce with the wrist, allowing crisp and rapid articulations that would never be possible on a viol. A violinist has an impressive bag of tricks. The best, most resonant tone comes from when the bow is drawn across the strings in the space midway between the end of the fingerboard and the bridge. If, on the other hand, the bow is moved up over the fingerboard, the sound becomes less resonant and more subdued. Bowing very close to the bridge produces a rough, raspy tone. Touching the strings lightly and not fully pressing them down results in the harmonic, a very high, fluty, and ethereal sound. And finally, there is the mute. A mute is a small, comb-shaped piece of metal or wood that fits over the strings, and it rests between the bridge and the tailpiece when it's not being used. But when called into use, it is pushed up in contact with the bridge, where it dampens the sound vibrations just enough to produce, well, a muted tone. A little bit of trivia is that the phrase that calls for the mute to be used is, in Italian, con sordino. Everybody gets a little fun out of translating that as with sardines. Unlike other instruments in the orchestra, a number of violins play the same part. Two players share a stand reading one piece of music. Since violins play more notes than any other instrument, and sometimes continuously, it's occasionally necessary to turn pages. A protocol has been developed for handling this. The player on the inside, farthest from the audience, stops playing and turns the page so that his partner won't miss a note. The outside player then plays a little louder to compensate. This is why string players share a stand, while winds and brass players each have their own stands. Violinists are natural leaders, but that has nothing to do with their character. It's visual. Violins are held at head level with the bow and right arm raised over the instrument. Lifting the bow in preparation for playing a downbeat is a clear signal that it's visible to everyone. The up and down movements of the bow show the tempo, and peripheral vision helps keep everybody together. Wait, isn't that the conductor's job? Well, in the late Baroque, conductors hadn't been invented yet, because the music of that day just didn't need them. It was easy enough just to watch the violins. The act of playing a string instrument is unique in that others can read the physicality of the gestures involved, the movements of the bow, the placements of the fingers on the strings. String players are very good at reading the body language of their colleagues. Anybody who's read a concert program knows that the first chair, first violinist is called the concertmaster. That's a literal translation of the German word Konzertmeister. The English, however, seem to have a different word for everything, so in the UK, this person is called the leader. But whatever you call them, this person is traditionally the best violinist in the orchestra and has special responsibilities. The concertmaster decides how to bow each phrase. He is responsible for playing any solos, and often in rehearsal will address other strings, particularly the other violins, making technical corrections or suggestions relative to their performance. He presides over the orchestra's tuning at the beginning of rehearsals and performances. And although this ritual seems very ceremonial and archaic, the concertmaster has the power to request that a section tune more carefully and even to single out players. Doesn't happen often, but I've seen it. In days of yore, if the maestro missed a train or was otherwise indisposed, the concertmaster would fill in, often standing on the podium and gesturing with his violin. You may have noticed that I've used the masculine pronoun in referring to the concertmaster. This is because in professional orchestras until about the mid-20th century, this position was always held by a man. The German term is masculine, Konzertmeister. If a student or amateur orchestra had a female concertmaster, the Germans would call her die Konzertmeisterin. Americans translated this literally into concertmistress, which thankfully has gone the way of poetess, usherette, stewardess, and aviatrix. Today, the person standing in that chair, sitting in that chair, I should say, is the concertmaster, whether they identify as he, she, or they, them. Maybe the British were onto something with the leader. So I'll leave you with one parting violin joke. Once you violin, you can't viol out. Next podcast, we'll look at the rest of the strings. It shouldn't take as long because since they all belong to the same family, they share many of the same characteristics of the violin. Until then, stay safe and healthy, and thanks for listening. I'm Stephen Larson.